Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Monday, September 26, 2011. Tech News Today is brought to you by Slingbox, which just turned your iPad into a television. Slingbox has a new iPad app, so now you can watch your home TV on your iPad anywhere you take it. Check it out at Best Buy or slingbox.com/twit. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Maya Zachter.
I'm Jason Howell.
And joining us today to kick around some of the tech news, Mr. Nilay Patel from thisismynext.com, soon to be The Verge. How's it going, Nilay?
It's going really well. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being with us. Appreciate it. You're getting close to the transformation, to the morphing of This Is My Next into The Verge. You're on the verge.
Actually, you can't. My wings are, they're budding. They're back. Yeah. We're going to come out of our shell soon. Really soon, we will have The Verge. And we're really excited about, you know, just before we start, I was saying, you know, I've been seeing some of the design stuff that's going on and some of the actual technology we're going to use to, like, make news happen. And it's really exciting. I don't want to talk about it too much because I, you know, talk about myself. But, It's going to be great. I think people are going to freak out and kill everyone. No, freak out. Like it.
It's going to bring upon the apocalypse.
Wait,
good to know.
Are you launching on December 21st, 2012?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. They're launching long before that.
Everyone who's upset with Facebook's timeline can now just channel their rage somewhere else once they get used to the ticker.
There you go. Well, Amazon is not keeping quiet in advance of their big Wednesday announcement. Today, they put out a press release announcing a deal with Fox to bring streaming to their Amazon Instant. That means that if you're not an Amazon Prime subscriber, you can rent things, you know, by regular rental contract, or you can stream them instantly for free if you're an Amazon Prime subscriber. 2,000 titles from Fox, including Arrested Development, Office Space, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, The Wonder Years. So a bunch of old movies, bunch of old complete series. I don't think you're going to see, like, current episodes of Fringe.
This is the first time that Wonder Years is going to be available for streaming. So
is that right?
That's true. Dump on that right away.
Yeah.
Even on DVD, right? It's not on DVD because of the music.
They have a lot of music, a lot of 60s music in there. It's very, very expensive. And especially the Joe Cocker cover of the Beatles song.
Yep. It's a good show. I mean, who didn't watch The Wonder Years? People who weren't alive yet, I guess.
I like how they haven't been able to because it's not available. Now it is.
And I mean, I like how they broke it out. You know, it's like it's such a, you know, iconic show, like, or at least they think it is. They're like, for the first time ever, The Wonder Years.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
I mean, was it? I don't know. I guess I don't win anything.
Do you? Who did?
Who did? You know?
Who did exactly?
Me.
She's the one who got away.
You were a Becky
really?
Cooper
Come
fan?
On, let's be honest, Sarah. You had a little bit of a winny thing.
Well, I like the actual actress because she's like a
See?
Math nerd.
There you go.
But no, I wasn't in love with her when I was.
You were in love
10.
With her brain.
Right.
Also, All Things D reporting that Hearst, Condé Nast, and Meredith publishers make things like Home and Garden, that kind of stuff, all have deals to sell digital versions of their titles on the new Amazon tablet. No Time, Inc. yet. Industry sources say publishers have tailored some of their titles for a 7-inch tablet that Amazon plans to unveil on Wednesday. And there's lots of leaks about that coming from MG Siegler at TechCrunch and Ryan Block over at Gadget. MG says that the new tablet will be called the Kindle Fire.
That name is asking for trouble. If that overheats
that
once,
is problem.
Well, that's once.
That was awesome. That fact was amazing.
You have a nightmare.
The Kindle, you Kindle flames. I get it.
We all sort of said Kindle Fire. First reaction, you guys both went overheating issues.
Overheating.
Yeah.
But Kindle Fire. It's a Kindle that's souped up. I don't know. I think it's pretty catchy.
It doesn't fit their naming convention. They have the Kindle and then the Kindle DX. And how does Fire fit into that?
Well,
anyway,
I think Fire is catchier than DX.
What?
DX
you
is
don't want
like,
two nonsense letters together?
It's like a base model of a Honda Civic.
So it should be
a
DX.
Isn't a Kindle Fire, I mean, isn't that just like a small, crappy fire? Like, that's what actually really gets me about it. It's like you don't want a kindling fire. You
well, the,
like
the Kindle fire. The Kindle causes a big fire. It right. kindles.
Maybe it'd be called the bonfire.
The Kindle strike anywhere.
Yeah, no, their new record by Bonfire. It's great.
Yeah.
Wait.
Ryan Block at Gadget reports that Quanta, the company that designed the playbook for RIM, also designed the Kindle Fire and used the playbook as a hardware template, so you can expect that the Kindle Fire will look quite a bit like the RIM playbook. In fact, MG over at TechCrunch reports no email client will be included on the Kindle Fire. So it does have a lot of similarities to a playbook.
That's very strange. You know, I read a report over the weekend. I think it was Forrester saying that the number one thing people do with tablets is email. And you have to think Amazon kind of knows that this whole thing about Quanta building, you know, Quanta makes everything. You know, saying because Quanta built something, it has to look like something else Quanta built. That's makes kind of no sense.
No. And he does say that the Quanta specifically used the playbook as a hardware template. It's not just because Quanta made it that you would jump to that conclusion. It's a good point. But the interesting thing is that they didn't use their Kindle team to build this. And they have an internal team that has designed the past Kindles. So I guess their specialty is building e-book readers, and they want to go outside to somebody who has experience building tablets.
Even that feels like a little, you know, I'm sure it's grounded. Ryan's a great reporter, so I'm sure it's grounded in some sort of reality. But even that feels shaky to me. I mean, if I'm the Kindle team at Amazon and I'm building what will become like the, you know, the first maybe real competitor to the iPad, I want to be in charge of that, right? I mean, I don't see them saying the future of this is more e-ink devices. It feels to me like Amazon would be a bit more proprietary about this. You know, just the length of time we've heard that they've been working on it and the length of effort and the amount of effort they've put into it, it seems like they're going to, you know, tablets are all about software. And it sounds like this tablet in particular is going to be about forking Android, making a proprietary operating system, and doing something with Android that's completely different than anything we've seen before. And, you know, you have to express software through hardware. So saying we're putting all of this effort into software and then punting on the hardware, It feels shaky to me. I'm really hoping that Ryan got it wrong. Not because I want Ryan to get it wrong, but because I want the product to be better than what he's saying it's going to be.
Now, I like the playbook as a piece of hardware. I think it's the implementation that RIM has done and the fact that they don't have any apps that has been the big failure. It actually works very well as an e-reader.
But as if they actually went ahead and used a playbook as the model, at this point, that's been out for a while. Wouldn't it actually help Amazon for the pricing structure if they're using somewhat of a pre-existing design? They say, okay, look, we'll just slap our software on there.
And they're talking about $250 to $300.
Right now, the playbook's price being slashed in places like Staples to $299. So if they're selling it for $299, and that's the playbook, which used to be at $499, maybe the Fire, even with an old design, could get away at a pretty low price point. It's something Amazon really wants.
Is it? Well, I agree with you. They definitely want a low price point. But is it like using old? It's not like they're buying old playbooks. Like that can't have been.
No. It's just using it as a reference.
They'd be
design.
The only ones.
Right. We sold 250,000 playbooks this quarter. 200 of them to Amazon.
Actually,
no,
that'd be like, really interesting.
I see them having started work on this so long ago that I don't see them saying, okay, we'll use a generation of hardware that's behind already. I think, you know, there's a way to do it where you want to be on top. And if you have to compete with Apple, you know, doing it with old hardware is not necessarily the way to go. I'm very curious about all this. You know, we're going to be at the event. We'll be covering it. I'm sure you guys are going to talk about it on Wednesday.
Yeah, we're going to stream coverage live that morning too. You know, looking at all the live blogs and everything. Hopefully there'll be somebody streaming.
But it's, of all the events I've been to, I think this is the one I'm most excited to go to, just because I honestly have no idea what to expect from these guys.
Well, and Ryan's theory, which I think, you know, has some merit to it, is that the Nook Color 2 is coming by the end of this year, and Amazon is rushing to get a tablet out there to compete with it. If that were true, that could cause Amazon to put something out that maybe isn't 100% what they would want.
As a no email client.
As in something like that.
Or email makes people unhappy. We're just going to strip that entirely.
Well, and email clients will be available in the App Store from Amazon and available on the web, so it's not like you're barred from email. But
as long as it's not as ugly as the Kindle One, it ought to be fine, I'd imagine. It has to be better looking than that thing.
They have to learn something there. You know, that email client thing, I think, points to something bigger, which is that they really did fork Android. Like, Android's gone. It's not there. There's no Google Mail client in there. There's no Google integration at all. They took all that stuff away.
So that's a really good point.
I mean, that to me is like, this is it. This is, we laughingly talk about Android fragmentation all the time. But here it is. Like, it happened. Like, Amazon took it and they're running with it in a different direction as fast as they can.
Well, what I've always looked at is the idea that Google says, look, Android's open. Anybody can use it without a license, but you don't get any of our apps. And Amazon looked at that and said, hey, we can do apps. We'll start an app store. We've got our own streaming. We have, you know, ebooks. Let's do it without Google and see how it goes. I'm interested to see what it looks like, just like everybody else is. Along with the deals being announced. Netflix announced a deal with DreamWorks Animation today that will allow them to stream exclusively the studio's new films starting in 2013. So if we survive the apocalypse and the end of the Mayan calendar, we'll be able to get exclusive access to new Pixar or DreamWorks animation.
I wish it was Pixar.
I know. Sure, it's a slip that of the even the last slip person left on Earth will have forgotten about this by the time they can actually stream DreamWorks content.
Yeah, so starting in 2013, they get exclusive access to new DreamWorks animation movies, and then shortly thereafter, they'll get library content like Ants, Kung Fu Panda, and this is a deal that HBO had previously, and HBO is letting DreamWorks out of their contract early in order to do the deal with Netflix, the difference being that Netflix is allowing DreamWorks to sell digital copies of the movies during an exclusive window, whereas HBO said, when we have it first on TV, you can't sell any digital copies. So that's why you would see DreamWorks Animation movies disappear from places like iTunes when they went on to HBO.
Yeah, again, this is DreamWorks Animation. They have like a total of like, what, 22 movies right now? So it's not a huge library that they, well, that's a right now. So I figure there'll be like, what, three more by 2013? Not a whole lot of, but that's like big things like Shrek. These are some quality movies, How to Train Your Dragons, things that actually did pretty well in the box office. So I think it's not a huge like win for Netflix to get DreamWorks, and they definitely needed to do it for the PR move. But I think it's a good step that if they have competitors out there in the subscription fields and like Blockbuster and now with Dish, if they go, look, we have DreamWorks Animation exclusively, maybe they could use that eventually in the future to go, you know what, other people trust us with this, we can get exclusives later on.
You know, this is the future of the media industry now, are going to be these content partnerships. You know, and now that Netflix is kind of like, they have to make this work. Like, they can't rely on the DVD model anymore, right? Because they spun off Quickster. I think you're going to see a lot of aggressive deal making, like, very soon. I mean, we're seeing it today, right? There's two deals in one day. It's kind of like, why is that suddenly happening out of the blue? But I think that the real key to all this is that even as these studios are making their deals with the middlemen service providers, they're kind of moving forward with like their Ultraviolet initiative to wrap up all this DRM together so that you can buy a movie from Walmart and then you can buy an Amazon device, you can stream it, and it's the same DRM that's managed centrally. So it's kind of like they're playing both sides of this thing. And, Netflix is the one who's, I think, eventually going to get squeezed really hard with this. I think DreamWorks, you're right, it's an exclusive. It's not an exclusive, right? They're saying you can stream it, but we'll still sell it. And I think that's their out. And I think we're gonna see them making use of that out pretty strongly. And I think Netflix has to get more aggressive about being the real exclusive vendor if they want to survive in a world where the studios are trying to centralize their DRM.
Yeah, and this is not the big announcement that's going to save Netflix. Netflix needs a big announcement that's going to start before 2013 and has a bigger library than DreamWorks Animation has. It's not a bad deal, though. Absolutely not.
I was thinking about when Apple launched iTunes, right? We're at the very beginning. So we have a music store, and we've brought on the five biggest labels. Like, let's go. Now, here's a store. It's like, it doesn't have everything. It's only like 200,000 tracks or whatever it was when it first started. But it's like the 200,000 tracks you want. Netflix is like, we don't have everything, but we have these 30 TV shows from the 80s that you might like. You know, and it's like they've got to make a big splash somewhere to have the content people want, which is, I think mostly it's first-run movies, right? I mean, that's what I think I want when I look at Netflix. And I think they've got to find a way to make that happen.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to our coverage of Patent Wars. It's a three-front war between Apple and Samsung, and events in every theater today. Nilay, if you can help us out, let's start with Australia, where Judge Annabelle Bennett may grant a brief injunction over the Galaxy Tab 10.1. They had their arguments in court today, and Samsung has revised the tab, but it wasn't enough for Apple, right?
It wasn't. You know, it's interesting what Apple's going at with these things. It's a combination of patents on user interface features and like deep hardware features, like how the modem works. And so Samsung, it's easy for Samsung to like get out of the user interface ones, right? It's okay, we'll change slide to unlock. We'll change the bouncing and list and that stuff. And that's kind of what Samsung is saying will change, right? We'll make these changes to software. What they can't do is they can't make changes to things like design patents and how the thing actually looks. And it's really hard for them to go.
Although they slapped their brand name on the front of the thing. So
right.
that seemed to be one of the big things they're making.
Just made by Apple.
Not designed in California, bike.
I mean, stuff like that is like, you have to wonder why Samsung didn't do it from the beginning. And I think, you know, that's one of the things that courts around the world have been saying to Samsung is there are other ways to do this. and you should go ahead with it. And that's kind of what is happening in Australia. They're saying, well, this is a copy. And, you know, you're making these changes to things that you should have changed to begin with. And, you know, Apple is being harmed. You know, people might well get confused with this. And you're using some of their patented stuff. So when brief injunction is like, it's an injunction that'll hit now and then they'll go through the case. You know, I'm not some expert on Australian law, but all of the rules about injunctions in all of these countries are basically the same. You know, getting a preliminary injunction is like really hard. And you have to prove that if you don't act right away, like, you know, there will be a harm, an irreparable harm that can't be cured later, right? So in a lot of cases, it's, you know, it's cutting down a tree, I think, is a classic example. If I come to your house and threaten to cut down your tree, you can go to the judge and say, you know, you have to stop it because if it cuts down the tree's gone and you can't just pay me to make it better. And that's like, you know, that's sort of the classic case. So all these injunction cases that are happening now, either Samsung or Apple has to say, if we don't stop this right now, there will be a harm that you can't fix later by just paying me money. And that's going to be the standard for all of these. And, you know, slightly different ways to different countries.
And Samsung launched a Panzer attack into Apple-held Netherlands, suing, claiming Apple is violating technology patents concerning areas like 3G technology. Some interesting revelations in court there. Apple says it pays a license to Intel Infineon that should cover this stuff, that Intel Infineon has licensed it from Samsung. Also, Apple accused Samsung of a patent ambush and claimed that Samsung is demanding 2.4% of the price of each chip to be paid in royalties. All of this according to tweets from Andreas Udo de Haes, an editor at Dutch publication Weberwereld. I'm totally mispronouncing all of that, so my apologies to the Dutch. But in essence, this is, you know, live tweets from inside the courtroom. Is this any different than what we were just talking about in Australia, except it's Samsung now doing the pushing towards Apple?
You know, it's the same standard. It's, you know, unless you stop it now, you can't fix it later with money, right? And I think Samsung, this is more like the Nokia-Apple thing, right? Nokia and Apple were fighting over 3G patents, and they eventually settled because everybody needs to share those, and it's understood that you need to share those. But I think Samsung kind of made a tactical error here because they're basically admitting that they've known about this patent infringement since 2007 when the iPhone was shipped, and now they're saying, well, if you don't stop it now, we'll be irreparably harmed. And it's like, well, no, you haven't. You're fine. You're selling more phones than anybody. And the iPhone's been infringing these patents since 2007. So I don't know that the judge is going to look too kindly on this. But this pattern of what you're seeing is you're seeing both sides try to aggressively outmaneuver each other in the court. And I think all of these jurisdictions are saying to these guys, you know, it's great that you're in the court and you're making use of the process here. What you really need to do is sit down in a boardroom and hammer out an actual agreement that covers what you're going to do and how much each of you is going to pay the other.
Right. And it is sort of a game of chicken, right? Where they're waiting to see which side will blink first and agree to go to the table.
Right. And I think Apple feels very strongly that Samsung has to blink. And I think that's really what makes this, you know, I think Samsung thought that they could kind of negotiate their way out of this pretty quickly. I think it was over the weekend or maybe on Friday that a Samsung executive said, we have to be more aggressive. We can't be so passive in our response to this. And I think that's what you're seeing here. You're seeing Samsung start to step up its efforts because they've begun to realize that Apple isn't willing to settle easily, that they're not just going to go away.
And then in the U.S., a very interesting development, the last one we'll talk about before we get out of the patent stuff, Verizon filing on behalf of Samsung, saying the requested injunction of certain Samsung products will harm Verizon Wireless and U.S. customers. Is there trouble in the Verizon-Apple relationship now? I mean, what would make them come in on the side of Samsung here?
You know, what's interesting about this one is that the only devices Samsung has, their brief covers, are Samsung's LTE devices. So it's the Galaxy Tab LTE, the Droid Charge, and something else. And this is Verizon saying we need more LTE devices in the market. You know, they don't sell a ton of them, right? There's only three or four manufacturers that have LTE devices for Verizon to sell. I think it's just three. I think it's just HTC, Motorola, and Samsung. So for them, losing a provider to an injunction over LTE devices will actually harm Verizon. Now, they've wrapped it in what you have to wrap it in because, you know, they're not a party to the lawsuit. So the only reason there's only a few avenues for a third party to file an amicus brief like this, and one of them is in the public interest, right? So Verizon has to wrap it in the language of, well, if we don't sell a lot of LTE devices, the American public will be harmed, which I don't think the judge is going to buy that. I think the judge is going to say, well, you're ultimately Samsung's real customer, And you should have told them, don't copy the iPhone when you spec'd out the Droid Charge. And, you know, I'm sure the judge will accept the brief. Whether or not he'll be convinced by it or it will be mentioned in the case or have any relevance to anything is, I think that's pretty shaky.
All of these lawsuits harm my brain in that respect. I wish they would just all figure it out, but they will. It's just a matter of time. Let's take a quick break to rest your brain and tell you about something nice for once. This episode is brought to you by Slingbox. Just in time for the holidays, Slingbox introducing their new iPad app. You've heard us talk about this. The iPad app basically turns your iPad into a television because it takes all of your television and puts it on your iPad and it puts it on your phone and it puts it on your laptop. You can have everything you get, whether it's over the air, whether it's on a DVR, whether it's through your cable system, whether it's even on-demand content. Anything that comes into your television then goes through the Slingbox and then out over your internet connection to your internet-connected device wherever you are, and you don't pay anything else except what you pay for the actual Slingbox and any of the apps that you buy to put on your mobile devices. Check it out. Watch your home TV on your iPad anywhere you take it. See a demo at Best Buy or check it out at slingbox.com/twit. Slingbox on your home TV, appearing on iPads everywhere. Look, there's one. There's one.
Wait, is that a Samsung Tab? No.
Yeah. Can't tell.
I can't tell the
difference. If only there was a sign.
Yeah.
Maybe they should
or a label.
Yeah, like a rounded, a different edge or something.
All right. Let's talk about this Windows Phone location information thing that Rafael Rivera discovered.
Yeah, Microsoft was hit with a lawsuit a while ago about that Windows Phone was sending out location information about people without consent. And so Rafael Rivera, who was behind the Windows Phone jailbreaking tool Chevron WP, he wanted to check out if this was true or not. So he went into the OS. And he found out that before you see this screen that says allow the camera to use your location, information is being sent out. The OS version, the device information, wireless access points in the vicinity of the handset, and various GUID-based identifier. So basically, pinpoint information, where you are in any given location, can be found out before you allow the camera application to send out location data. So that does not look good for Microsoft because they have said to the House of Representatives, yeah, our OS doesn't do that. So they probably didn't lie intentionally, but it looks like there's a bug.
Yeah, Rivera hypothesizes what's happening is the camera is actually calling up the location services in preparation for you tagging a photo or being able to do that stuff. And then location services is caching that result ahead of time. And that this is sort of an unintentional bug that Microsoft needs to fix, but it does technically contradict what they told the House of Representatives.
It is sort of a yikes thing, too. I mean, I know some of us don't feel like, ooh, gosh, this is such a privacy issue. You know, we feel so exposed in this way, but some people will. And even though I don't think that Microsoft is deliberately withholding information and secretly trying to figure out where we're all going all the time, it's just embarrassing for them. It's embarrassing if they didn't realize that this is what was going on.
Well, and it's one of those things where it's like, I almost hate to accuse Microsoft of anything because we don't even know if it's stored. It may just be cached and it may be ephemeral. It's obviously not Microsoft intentionally taking location information and logging it for their own nefarious purposes.
Right, and then lying about
it. And so I'm not even sure what the damage is here. In fact, there's a related story today that a judge dismissed the iPhone privacy class action lawsuit around location information because he said you can't show damage. You're saying all these things about they collected this location information and therefore there were opportunity costs and personal information was misappropriated. But the judge said you've got to show that something bad happened, that there was damage.
Well, apparently, what do you get, like targeted ads when you have a location, when your information is known? Or like what exactly happens when, you know, I'm sitting right here? Well, you could offer me some candy or say.
Well, I think the iPhone one. I think that complaint was drafted poorly by, like, you know, an opportunistic class action lawyer hoping to get a settlement. I mean, there's a reason I don't like tell our guys to hit a lot of these class action lawsuits until they get certified as, you know, they're parasitic in a way. I mean, they're good because, you know, a lot of times they're good for the consumer and, you know, they're sort of the check on the system that they represent the consumer, but a lot of them are in fact parasitic. So I think the problem with that one is not that Apple did something wrong that, you know, needed to be checked. I think the problem is there was written by bad lawyers, right? And they claimed the wrong thing. The Microsoft thing, I think, is interesting. I think it points to something that every kind of OS needs when they're doing this location stuff. They just need a log of what's tracking what when. And if you could just go into settings and be like, look at the location log, and you could see camera app figured out where I was at 5:04. You know, notes figured out where I was at 3:07. And you could just do that. I think everybody would just calm down. They would know what's going on, and they could say, well, I want that app to stop tracking me. I want the phone to stop knowing where I am. I want this app to track me more. You know, I think that would be make it a lot simpler for people to understand what their phones are doing. The reason people get hysterical about this is because they don't know it, and they don't understand what it's doing or how to stop it. And so it's like this confluence of confusion and, like, you know, Frady Cat coverage. It kind of makes hypes up this problem as something that's not. Whereas if the manufacturers and the operating system vendors would just say, this is what your phone is doing, and you could go see it, I think a lot of this would be tempered.
Yeah, because the programmers that are writing these apps are not concerned with the storage of location information. They're concerned with an efficient program. And if they know, like, a big use of the camera app is going to be geotagging photos, and that's true. People geotag photos on purpose all the time, then they're going to try to come up with the most efficient way of doing that. And they're not necessarily going to be considering what the servers are doing to store that information on the other side. So I think you're right. If you just tell people, like, here is what it's doing with location information, and you can turn it on and off, just make that simple. It's a step that needs to be taken now that we have so much ubiquitous tracking. And it's not like in the olden days when, you know, GPS didn't work half the time. With with GPS and Skyhook-like functions, you can be your phone can locate itself 99% of the places you are.
Right.
Let's move on to GigaOhm's Mobilize 2011, where T-Mobile's chief marketing officer, Cole Broadman, showed off a couple of new phones coming to T-Mobile. The HTC Amaze 4G will be one of the first two phones to take advantage of the 42 megabit per second HSPA Plus. That's the fast HSPA Plus that T-Mobile has. In practice, it gets about 8 megabits per second, can spike up to 20, but it's a good fast phone. It's got a 4.3-inch screen, 8 megapixel camera, and it's coming out along with the Galaxy S2. Both these phones have 1.5 gigahertz Snapdragon processors, NFC chips, and 1080p video recording. The HTC Amaze will be $260, the Galaxy S2 $230. Those are both on a 2-year contract, coming online October 10th and in stores October 12th. So a couple of nice phones coming.
Can I just say, HTC and T-Mobile will need to, like, slow their roll with the phones. It's like, how many in the past 4 months? It's like 5 or 6. It's ridiculous. I mean, how are you supposed to know which one to buy? A MyTouch 4G Slide, a HTC Sensation, the Amaze. I would imagine that...
Well, the Amaze is kind of like dead center between those two phones you just mentioned as far as the features, right?
I mean, it's a Sensation. I mean, there's not a lot different between that and the Sensation. It has a better camera, which is great. It has this new radio in it, which is great. But, like, why would you buy a Sensation now? Why not just kill the Sensation 3 months after you launch it?
Eli, let me tell you, what you're supposed to do is go into the T-Mobile store and let one of their professionals help you.
You know, I always ask this question whenever they do this. I always ask. So when somebody comes in your store and says, what phone should I buy? And they hold up, you know, in this case, the Amaze and the Sensation, which one do you tell them to pick? And they're like, well, we evaluate every customer's individual needs. And I'm like, there are not a lot of individual needs that
we take a blood sample and evaluate their endocrine system to match them.
It could just be T-Mobile pretending they're still a phone company before they get bought. Oh. Otherwise, they're going to look like, oh, what are we doing? Nothing.
Somebody had to go there.
They have to do something and keep introducing these phones. Like, we have deals with HTC. Just keep putting them out there.
They're just talking AT&T.
By the way, Broadman also pretty much put to rest the idea that T-Mobile would get the iPhone this year. He said, the ball is in Apple's court. We'd love to have the iPhone whenever Apple lets us know. Later on, he pretty much said, yeah, we don't have any plans to have an iPhone. Not that they don't want it, but it's not happening. Also revealed that over 75% of his company's phones sold in 2011 were smartphones, so a high percentage, with 90% of those powered by Android. Means the other 10% were probably RIM.
Those are BlackBerry phones.
Yeah, and that actually is a small percentage of BlackBerry, I have to say. T-Mobile used to be pretty heavy with the BlackBerry phones.
Well, RIM's losing ground everywhere, so it's not that surprising that T-Mobile people want to go get these Android phones, or the fact they have hundreds of HTC phones, apparently.
Well, let's finish up with this study from the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism about sources of local news. Getting a lot of attention from a lot of folks today because of what it says about how we gather our local news, not national news, but news about where we live. 74% of folks get local news from television still. So television far from dead, but they pretty much rely on it for breaking news, weather, and traffic. It's not for in-depth stuff. 55% get news from word of mouth, talking to their neighbors. 50% get from radio. Now, these numbers aren't going to add up to 100 because people get their news from multiple sources. So 50% get their news from radio, including traffic and political news, particularly. 50% get it from the newspaper. Newspapers, they rely on for local events, crime reports, cultural events like museum openings and stuff, local government news. And 47% get their news from the internet. Now, that may sound low, but they use the internet for two very interesting things. Local services like restaurants and bars and laundromats and recommendations, stuff you use Yelp for, mm-hmm. essentially.
Or
and
directly to the website of the company.
Primary sources for weekly local news. Actually, two-thirds of people surveyed used at least three primary sources for weekly local news. So they're going to government websites. They're going to corporate websites, business websites to find out what's going on at those places.
What's the age breakdown here? Because I assume that plays a lot into people who are watching local news on TV versus people who are following Twitter feeds for local news.
Yeah, the age breakdown is definitely different when you look above 40 or below 40. Television takes a big hit when you look at age 18 to 39.
It's interesting. I actually have a friend who works in local news in the Bay Area, and they do a lot of stories about the internet and social media and ways that people connect with each other.
Well,
and it's weird
if that's just
because I'm like, who's
watching?
Well,
you're in the Bay Area.
Yeah, I mean, that's the industry here. Is that why?
Well, I guarantee you,
my hometown newspaper in Racine, Wisconsin is not running Twitter stories. It's not. It's a little different there.
Well, I wouldn't say it's necessarily the story of who's leaving Twitter, but more the local news really trying to use the internet to connect with their viewers more.
I see what you're saying.
Twitter, it's interesting. Feeds and things like that.
I think that stuff is great, right? Because I think there's a generation of people who are working local news who realize that the small town newspaper is not the future, right?
Right.
I think that's what you're seeing in the age shift. It's, okay, well, I'm in the community. I'm doing reporting here. How do I connect with the most people? Well, this Facebook page is more effective than our WordPress site or whatever that we're running our newspaper CMS on. And I think that's actually kind of the difference here is that, traditional newspapers, you could buy a printing press and then you would basically get the same newspaper as the New York Times is printing in Racine, Wisconsin, right? It can generate essentially the same product. But digital news online is a technology-driven thing. And you have to have like a team of people to build a technology product for you to get news on the internet. And that's actually, maybe this is just my perspective because I'm trying to build a, technology product to get news to people right now. But that's actually really hard. And like knowing how design works on the internet, knowing how CMS works and figuring out how to serve news to people is a challenge. It's a technical challenge. And I think that's why local news right now is that's why it skews to television for people. And that's why people go to primary sources because the local newspaper website probably sucks, right? And I think that's what most people are finding, and that's why they're not caring about it as much as they could, and why they go to services like Twitter or Facebook, where the reporters can use a better tool to distribute news to people.
The best of Racine County results are in. That's the top story at the Journal Times.
I will say the Journal Times that I grew up reading the Journal Times, and my dad drove, and I was on the political radio thing. My dad drove me to middle school every day listening to Rush Limbaugh on the radio, so...
I understand
what's happening in America.
What's going to happen is that television and radio are going to migrate to your phone and your computer as we get better and better ubiquitous wireless access, and people realize, oh, I can plug my phone in to an aux jack in my car and listen to anything. They'll start doing that for their radio because they'll get used to wanting to do it for other things, and the phone will sort of replace the radio. I see that happening. But that's going to take a while, maybe a couple of years, few years to happen.
Well,
and I think radio survives this transition, and maybe television better than newspapers, because newspapers, They don't, the, you know, the, don't nobody's going to pick up that piece of paper anymore.
Well, there's no, this just in, once it's printed. You just can't do that. It's funny, our local paper, which, well, my local paper is the San Francisco Chronicle, has a website, which is sfgate.com, which is pretty good. But it's like, I don't even really go there anymore because I've found my favorite columnists on their Twitter feeds or sometimes their individual sites. So, yeah, just to, it's kind of fascinating the way that we decide to get our information.
Back to the whole age thing. I mean, like, it's a generational shift. I mean, I know back when I was in college, you know, it was the last generation of people who still had, like, televisions. Because the next, like, the freshmen didn't after a while. And, like, you just have a computer after a while. You don't bother. You're like, okay, why would you need a television? You get all your content a certain way. And the fact is you can communicate a lot more directly with Twitter. And you have word of mouth kind of being like, okay, what's trending? That's more important to you than, like, what's coming out on the local news at 6 o'clock. Oh, okay, they're going to talk about this horrible story first and then the next thing. I mean, it's much more on demand. You want to know what's going on about a particular thing at the certain time you want to, and television just doesn't bring that nowadays.
No, they've got their old form. I mean, I used to work in television, so it's like, coming up at 6, what did Mark Zuckerberg introduce at F8? And you're like, are you kidding? Everyone already knows that.
Should I look that up? Should I wait?
The chemicals in your closet will kill you, and what Mark Zuckerberg's announcing. Coming up at 10. That was another interesting thing in this survey is that nobody goes to television websites. Television has not done a good job of convincing people to use their presence on the web, and that's a dangerous thing for television.
But do you know why I would go to a television website? It's to watch television. Like, if I'm going to the ABC News website or whatever, like, I just want to watch the thing that I want to watch. I actually find that incredibly frustrating. I think all these broadcasters are missing an opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where you could just go and watch. They're already selling the ads. They can just count more viewers. I mean, that's what they do, right? They show ads to people. So I don't know why they can't just show them to me on my computer.
They want to frustrate you to watch it on TV, clearly. I mean, have you been to the network sites where you're like, where is the video anyway?
Right. And it's like, well, I guess I'll just watch Justin TV because you didn't figure this out. Like, that's what I'm going to do because it's easier for me to do that than anything that you're doing right now.
All right, let's move on to the news fuse. A J.P. Morgan report said that Apple had cut back its orders of iPad parts by 25%, and then people started to think maybe this meant demand for the iPod was iPad was dropping, which led to Apple's stock price taking a small hit. However, some analysts think that J.P. Morgan got it wrong. Gene Munster of Piper Jaffray thinks J.P. Morgan misinterpreted Apple's supply chain information, and Chris Casso, an analyst at Susquehanna, called the report misleading and argued that Apple's shift is just a scheduling adjustment and not a cut. We'll have to see.
In other iPad news, remember those rumors of a Facebook app for iPad? Lance Ulanoff over at Mashable is reporting Facebook is going to launch its long-awaited iPad app at Apple's iPhone 5 launch event on October 4th. Former Facebook engineer Jeff Verkoyen recently wrote a blog post saying that he had headed up a team. They built that app. It had been feature complete for months. He's since modified the blog post to remove specific references to time periods and mentions of the app. He's also announced that he's off to Google's mobile team.
A blurry shot of a slide at a Google-sponsored event shows definitive proof that the Google Drive is coming. Apparently, Apparently, G Drive has been in existence since 2007 and has been internally tested, killed, and might actually just end up as a new name for Google Docs. You could upload files to Google Docs since last year, and the rumors also say you should expect some kind of desktop syncing application like Dropbox.
I think that makes sense. You just make Google Docs the Dropbox of Google because it's almost already there.
If they ever do Chrome OS right, they want to have this.
Yeah. Three senators are less than thrilled with OnStar. The company said it would continue tracking former customers unless they opt out. We talked about that on Friday. Senators Al Franken and Chris Coons penned a letter to the company that said the move appears to, quote, violate basic principles of privacy and fairness. Senator Chuck Schumer wrote to the FTC calling OnStar's decision one of the most brazen invasions of privacy in recent memory.
No, Chuck Schumer sounds totally different.
YouTube is going to start offering scheduled programming on new channels, according to the Wall Street Journal. Google's currently getting all the deals done to bring fashion and sports content, for example, to YouTube. Programming could be ready in as soon as 60 days, but the service wouldn't officially launch until early 2012 with about a dozen or so channels.
Scheduled programming on the internet?
It's a
weird idea.
It's like local news. all over again.
A new piece of software called AirShark can detect non-Wi-Fi interference from things like Bluetooth devices, cordless phones, and microwaves using only regular stock Wi-Fi cards. AirShark was developed by researchers at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Unlike other products like Wispy, AirShark doesn't need any extra hardware. So you can use AirShark on your laptop's stock Wi-Fi card. So once you find out interference, you can use the software to resolve those issues.
It's AirShark week. Zynga's Cityville is coming to Google Plus today.
Tom could not be more excited.
Seriously excited. announcing the deal, Zynga said that Cityville is its largest game on Facebook. Everybody thinks of Farmville, but Cityville's bigger. They hope to one day bring cross-platform compatibility so you could visit your friends on Facebook from your Google Plus city. Question now becomes, will Cityville unseat Angry Birds from its position as the number one game on Google Plus? That is the question.
This is my next. I heard those guys were pretty cool.
They're good folk.
That's what I heard. They have details about the Motorola Zoom 2 Media Edition. The tablet would have an 8.2-inch HD screen, weigh a little under a pound. So if you're wondering, well, what does Media Edition mean? This Zoom 2 will have a subwoofer along with an integrated IR remote so that you can control home theater components. Pretty cool. The Media Edition will also be pretty tough. You know, you can shake it around a little bit with a splash-proof Gorilla Glass display with a magnesium and aluminum chassis.
And it looks a lot like the Photon 4G, and it looks nothing like an iPad. There's a crazy idea.
No, Motorola's designs, we had a bunch of leaks. All their designs are super different now. It's kind of like all these companies realized that you could do something other than design a plain back square.
What an idea. Who knew? Maybe the circular. I can't wait for the circular tablet. Aw. That's next. New Spotify users will no longer be able to join its service without a Facebook account. So what if you don't want a Facebook account and want to still access Spotify? Yeah, you can't do that. However, if you were already using Spotify before its Facebook integration, you won't need to change anything. And Spotify has released a response to the backlash. Speaking of Facebook Connect, quote, think of it like a virtual passport designed to make the experience smoother and easier with one less username and password to remember.
Think of it as making it easier on our admins to integrate with Timeline.
Yeah.
Is actually what I think what they probably mean.
I will say the whole Spotify, like in RDO and all those services, feeding every song I listen to Facebook is incredibly annoying. Like, just.
No,
it's
but
not
it's,
that
it's,
I,
you mean frictionless.
Frictionless serendipity.
Well, real-time serendipity. How could you possibly have serendipity without constant sharing?
I agree. It's just, it's like, I'm not interested in what anyone else is listening to.
It is in the ticker on the right. I think that is a more elegant way of handling it than having it constantly spamming the news feed. But
If I want to know so badly and I'm connected with these people socially, I will connect with them socially via RDO or Spotify. Mm. I don't need it.
But it's easier. You have a passport.
No, I get. It's supposed to. All right.
Let's move on to the randomizer.
Randomizer.
A enterprising programmer named Jesse Anderson has taken it upon himself to experiment in a virtual situation with the idea that an infinite number of monkeys typing for an infinite number of time would eventually type out the complete works of Shakespeare. And he's making good progress. It turns out he's taking some shortcuts, though. He is allowing the virtual monkeys, so to speak, to spit out, I don't know, a string of like 9 letters at a time. And then his program scans that to see if they match letters from anywhere in the complete works of Shakespeare. If they do, he holds them and says, okay, we've got this part. And so he's building up the complete works of Shakespeare from these strings and making good progress there. He's not waiting for the entire works to be printed from beginning to end without a mistake.
The weird thing is he's just doing this on his home computer. He didn't farm this out, didn't create
well,
like
did.
A...
he did farm it out to Amazon EC2, right? But then it was costing him too much money, so he's moved it back to his home computer.
He's got to work on some kind of virtual monkey Shakespeare at home project for like PS3 cycles to be used so we can have millions of virtual monkeys at home.
Feeding into our Facebook timelines. That's the key that this is missing.
Just wait till he discovers Cityville.
I want every successful 9-character or 26-character string to show up in my ticker.
Leave nothing out. I need to know.
I like Ars Technica,
the future of media.
Ars Technica wrote and said, what Anderson is really showing is that a lot of very carefully supervised monkeys can eventually bang out fragments that cover a substantial portion of Shakespeare's text.
But they're still monkeys.
Well, they're virtual monkeys.
Did you read the I think the Telegraph did an article where they talked about a real experiment. They were comparing it to a real experiment with real monkeys. And the closer was amazing. It's like, the real monkeys did not succeed. They mostly typed the letter S and farted on the keyboard. And
it was I think I saw that on the BBC, too, where they were like, yeah, they just typed the letter S until the keyboard broke. So
it's just like Shakespeare.
That was an early known work of Shakespeare. Yeah. The first
play. I don't know where to go from here.
As Roland Emmerich will show in the movie Anonymous, those monkeys weren't even Shakespeare at all. They were a nobleman. Let's move on to the calendar.
The HTML5 Developer Conference takes place in San Francisco tomorrow at the Westin, tomorrow, September 27th. Also tomorrow, the 27th, Google was founded back in 1998.
Or so was it?
Happy 13th birthday Eve, Google, if this is indeed your birthday.
Because they have lots of birthdays there. Birthday
there's the whole, day. Like, here's when we were founded. Uh-huh. Here's when we were incorporated. Here's when we got our first check. Here's when we just started working on a concept called something else.
Here's when we got an argument with Yahoo and then decided to change our birthday.
Here's when we began tracking your every move.
Right. Here's your birthday.
That's a different move.
Well played.
Very good. Good one. Amazon's holding a press conference on Wednesday the 28th around what's now believed to be called the Kindle Fire. And it's starting at 7 a.m. Pacific time. We will be here live here on Twit covering it. And by we, I mean Tom and Leo, because that's early.
Yeah, we'll be starting the fire.
Definitely tune in. It'll be a lot of fun. Samsung's first Windows Phone Mango handset has been rather elegantly named the Omnia W.
Sounds like a luxury hotel.
It's launching in October. Yeah. It really does. Well, it's two.
It's a combination of two luxury hotels.
AT&T is starting to throttle wireless users this week. Now, if that gets you upset, these are unlimited data plan smartphone users that are in the top 5% of heaviest data users in a billing period. And AT&T's like, the vast majority of unlimited plan people are not going to be affected. And if you're on a tiered plan, this doesn't even apply to you. We will have to wait and see. If it starts applying to you, let us know. And Star Wars, The Old Republic, will launch on December 20th in North America and December 22nd in Europe. Although, Tom, you said that if pre-order people,
yeah,
folks
apparently
might
they're
going to
let
earlier.
People who pre-ordered in early based on how early they pre-ordered. So, you know, if you pre-ordered, you might get a little bit before December.
Right on.
Time for incoming. And that was Hate Bad Design's submission for incoming. I like that.
I love it.
Matt from Indiana called up 260 TNT Show and let us know his concerns about Facebook's timeline. And here they are.
Hey, tech crew. This is Matt from Indiana. I just had a thought. I don't know if it's old news already about the Facebook timeline. I feel like that's going to be a perfect opportunity for a security problem. I know for my bank website, if I forget my password, I could center in a bunch of personal information about myself, like the year I was married, my maiden name for my wife, or like a pet name. I feel like all of that stuff is going to be on that Facebook timeline, and it's going to be a really big security breach in resetting passwords for a bunch of different sites. I just thought it'd be something to bring up, and I wanted to hear what you guys had to think about it. Thanks.
Yeah, Matt, that is a fair concern, which is why you should be careful who you share your timeline with. But more importantly, forget Facebook. When you are given those challenge questions to answer, do not use real answers for those questions. That is very important, because if you use dictionary terms or easily discoverable information like your mother's actual maiden name, which is easy, really, it's not that hard to discover, mm-hmm. then you are actually creating a much less secure entry into your account than your password. You could have the most secure password in the world, but if your challenge question...
What city were you born in?
Is what city, yeah.
Scroll down, there it is.
Although I will say I do find it funny when like Citibank operators like call to confirm like security stuff. And they're like, yeah. What's your mother's maiden name? And I'm like, you know, Mustang 95.
Yeah.
She had a weird family.
she was from Palestornia Kovic in Western Asia, Europe. It's true. You should don't use real information there, but use secure information like Mustang 95. Of course, now we can all get into new
lives. I have to change everything now.
Yeah, exactly. On to the emails. Einal wrote in and said, in TNT 334, you discussed concerns regarding Meg Whitman's enterprise experience. Was it Lou Gerstner, the person who turned around IBM in the 90s, from American Express and RJR Nabisco? He was an outsider from day number one and was proud of it until the end. In his book, Who Says Elephants Can't Dance? He points out that the fixes he did were unique to IBM because of its culture and complexity. I think HP is close enough. So it's a good counterpoint to the idea that, well, Meg Whitman doesn't have enterprise experience. Maybe that's what HP needs?
Yeah, but American Express and Nabisco aren't anything like eBay, as far as I can tell. So, I mean, even if IBM is like HP, his analogy doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean, American Express and Nabisco share one major common attribute with IBM, which is that they're huge, dominant companies in the field, right? So he had experience managing companies of that size and scope. I mean, that's not to say Whitman won't do a good job. I think the biggest question for Meg Whitman is she in charge or is Ray Lane in charge? Well, because every time I see them do anything, it's both of them together, and Ray Lane is talking, and Meg Whitman is smiling and shaking her head.
There do seem to be possible strings attached to her arms and mouth.
Which, that's not her, right? I mean, that's not her personality or her reputation at all. It's very strange. I'm very curious to see how that plays out.
Next email from Dylan in Monroe, Wisconsin, who says, if Blockbuster streaming is only available to Dish customers, what could possibly make it any different than Dish On Demand that's currently built into every Dish set-top box? Why have two competing products? To me, the Surface offers nothing of use to customers until it can be used by anybody, regardless of content provider. All it's going to do is cannibalize DVD sales, or DOD sales, rather, and eventually fail because it was poorly implemented.
He means VOD sales, maybe.
VOD
Dish
sales.
On Demand, that's what he means.
Oh, VOD? Dish, okay. Yeah. No, it's like Department of Defense.
They sell a lot of things.
But, proprietary on-demand service, DOD. Eventually it failed because it was a poorly implemented, albeit potentially great service.
I think the Dish On Demand stuff on the set-top box is only in the set-top box. I don't think you can get it on PCs like you will with Blockbuster, which also has an Android app. So I think the reason why they're going with that is that Blockbuster already has a pre-existing application that you can use. That probably has a better name than going. Well, I know that's strange to say. Better name than
it's
Dish.
It's a well-known name. Whether or not you're a Blockbuster fan, everyone knows what Blockbuster does.
Yeah, everybody knows what it is.
I actually think the Blockbuster service is going to be great for Dish customers. I mean, it's cheap, right? It's $10 a month or whatever, and it's like new customers get it free, and you get DVDs in the mail and video games in the mail, and you get to stream all these movies, and you know they're going to be competing for exclusive streaming rights against Amazon and Netflix, just like everybody else. And if I was a Dish customer, I would definitely cancel Netflix and pay the $10 a month for this.
I think
it's like a no-brainer to me.
It's a bigger deal for DirecTV and maybe Comcast and Time Warner than it is for Netflix necessarily, because it just gives Dish a big advantage. At least that's my take on it.
Might have more access to network stuff, like the latest run things, versus this other streaming service that Blockbuster will have. So the real thing Dish needs to do is make sure it's easy to find one or the other, whatever the service may be.
Sure. All right. Thanks to everybody on our Reddit for submitting stories and voting them up or down, helping us figure out what to cover today. Pete C, Sorello, Jotted, PC Guy 88, Matt 3, Draconos, all kinds of other people were in there today. TechNewsToday.reddit.com. Look at it every day. Submit some stories, or even if you don't have time to submit stories, just vote for a couple that you want to see. And thank you, Neelai Patel, for joining us. Always a pleasure. It's always great to have your insights. Let folks know what's going on with The Verge and This Is My Next and where they can find it.
Well, we're at thisismynext.com. Soon we'll be at theverge.com sometime soon within this season. And it's always great to be on. Thanks for having me.
Yep. Thanks again, everybody, for watching and listening. Twit.tv/TNT is the place to find us on the web. 260-TNT-SHOW is our phone number. And you can email us, TNT@twit.tv. Nate Langston from Wired UK joins us tomorrow. We'll see you then.
Heisman finish.
It was like slow jams from you two today.